we no longer deal with the status quo because of innovation in technology and because of people's expectation and because of the extra filter we've got around having to transition in terms of our energy use. We've got some serious complexity, and it's almost like there's always every project that we do requires new thinking, not what we did last year or the year before.
Hello, Smart Community friends, and welcome to the first new episode of 2023. I'm so excited to have you back. We hope you enjoyed our summer series, sharing some of our favourite episodes over the previous 12 to 18 months. I am very excited for 2023. Lots of things happening, lots of things happening in 2022, but continuing those and building on them more and more. So stay tuned. We're in for a really exciting ride, I think. Although last time I said that was 2020, and we all know what happened there. But no, I'm excited. 2023, come at me. I hope you are all excited as well. Now, in today's episode, I have a fantastic conversation with an old friend of the show. He's not that old, actually. An old friend of the show, Dan Barr. Now, Dan has been on the show before and is a very good friend of mine, but that was way back in the early days in episode 44 in 2018. So Dan leads the multidisciplinary consultancy Better Cities Group and is a co-founder of the major event planning technology collaboration Better Events VR. The Better Cities Group specializes in design, economics, and engagement, and proudly supports clients in the private, public, and startup sectors throughout the APAC region. Now, in this episode, Dan and I discuss how our thinking has changed on a number of topics since 2018 and how the smart space in general has matured. We talk about the problem of unintended consequences of technology and the tension between political ambition and commercial reality in smart projects. Dan tells us a bit about some of the projects he's working on, and he tells us what he thinks will be the big story of the next 10 years in city and urban development. We discuss why we need to get the hierarchy right between people and cars when designing our cities, and the importance of both qualitative and quantitative data, what I like to call the numbers and the stories. We finish our chat talking about the emerging trend of geopolitical factors in the smart space. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoy making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Dan. How are you today?
Good. I'm excellent, Zoe. Good to, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have you back on. Now, for our long-term fans, we spoke last in 2018, episode 44. We're over 300 now, so that's a bit wild. So lots has happened since then. So let's, before we get into that, tell us who you are, your background, and what you're passionate about.
Okay, thanks. So yes, a lot has happened. My name's Dan Barr. I run a consultancy called Better Cities Group. At the time that we spoke in 2018, we were just starting the consultancy, and so now we're nearly 5 years down the track. My background is public health, urban design, previously having worked for state government, local government, and private sector. In 2018, we just finished working on the Commonwealth Games and felt like it was a really good time to start our multidisciplinary consultancy in some Better Cities Group. We do design, economics, and engagement. And since we last spoke, it's been a very, really busy 4 years. And hopefully we can talk about that.
Yeah, I was just looking at the show notes from the last episode and we hadn't even gone to Japan. Because it says Zoe and Dan's hopes for upcoming trip to Japan. So, yeah, we met. Well, we must have met before then, or I must have stalked you or something.
No, we met at a comp. I think it was a Smart Cities conference.
ASCA conference, maybe. Australian Smart Communities conference, because that's also mentioned in here. Yeah.
And then we had a great time in Tokyo. Very informative.
Yes. And karaoke. We did karaoke as well.
Yes, late into the night.
That trip. Wow, I haven't spoken about that. We were just talking about our colleague as well, Emma Hendry, who was on that trip as well, who I will be able to catch up with when I'm in London. But anyway, enough about me. But yes, that was the Future Leaders, Future Cities mission, which was, really, I guess, a catalyst for me to really think more deeply about smart cities and what that actually means to me. And that's, I changed the name of the podcast a few months after we came back, because I was like, oh, it's not for me. It was about the people. And we know that we can use all this different terminology, but then we were talking about, communities. And I know that that's something that's, that we share, that it's how do we solve these problems for people and using technology and data to do that. And I know that thinking about urban design and those type of things, like our cities really, or we shape our cities shape us. And what does that actually mean moving forward? But anyway, let's go broad first, then we'll dive into some of the things that you've been up to. What is a smart community to you?
Well, it's a really good question. Probably 5 years ago, I would have probably answered it differently. But the last 5 years, we've been working with communities and cities and helping them work through change. Honestly, I would say every project that we do, there's people are dealing with a different environment. They're dealing with different expectations. They're dealing with population growth. They're dealing with a different economy and changes to the economy. And so for me, it's becoming more and more a smart community is a community where government and the community can work really collaboratively. And it's almost where community has a stronger role in decision making without slowing things down and things being able to continue to occur. But us being able to make these transitions in how we live, how we're going to work. So for me, that's it. And so the technology, the technology is important and it helps us, it facilitates these kinds of discussions. But we think about the pandemic, we think about changes in technology and workforce, which changes in environment. A lot of the projects we're doing, we're dealing with flood resilience and all these types of things, urban farming. And so that for me is how do we continue to have strong communities, really strong democratic communities in a time of such rapid change? And I just do not think that any generation has seen the change that we are seeing in not just technology, but in the physical aspects of our world, in the expectations that community has of each other and of government, of how that we live our lives and how we work. And I'm just seeing this, that at the moment, that's the crux of what we do. And for me, a smart community going forward is one that's able to evolve really quickly whilst retaining the livability that we have in this country and using technology where appropriate to facilitate that. So that for me is, and I probably haven't thought about that question, but that for me is what it is at the moment.
No, I think you articulated that quite well. And I like how you said, it's about how we can adapt and move forward, but then also retaining those core values essentially of what our community is. And we know that communities shift and change over time, spatially, culturally, all these different things, but it's like, what are those core values for us at the moment with our, the knowledge and the resources and the things that are happening, the environment that's going on, and then how can we really then, but still, I guess, adapt and be resilient to this change as we know things are happening all the time around us. And I also agree, I think like the technology and data piece, and it's important, but it's not the driver, it's the enabler. I know, we probably sound like a broken record on the podcast, but I think the more we can say that, then the more that we can embed that in. And I think if we ignore the technology and data, it will happen to us. That's one of my biggest things. It's like, we can't ignore it. We need to be aware of it. We need to have the specialists in. We need to know what we have available because we know that it's embedded in our lives now. And if we ignore it, it's not going away, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you're right. Like, and we've talked about this plenty of times, that technology is there to support problems that we have or respond to problems that we have, not the opposite. And, yeah, so the tech exists for pretty much everything that we want to do. it's just what the market, you know, and we probably don't use it to its full potential in lots of different ways. But I think over the next 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, we'll see huge advancement in that space. But certainly, yeah, tech can't lead the conversation and be looking for a problem to solve. It's the opposite.
Mm. And I guess the other thing I'm just going to throw at you now, because I can, is we think, like, we often talk about tech being the enabler, but we know that tech also shapes our lives and changes them for better or for worse. Like, I don't think technology is inherently good or bad. It's how we use it and how the humans use it and who's in control of that and what happens and blah, 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 all those type of things as well, which is why we need to be so aware of it, because those unintended consequences are things that we need to think about. And, you know, we might think, oh, well, what's that got to do with planning and cities? It's got everything to do with planning and cities, right?
Yeah. So to give you an example of it, which responds to that question, we've been doing a lot of regional economic analysis projects. And one of the things that we were asked to do by the federal government is to look at Industry 4.0 capability on the Gold Coast region. And what we found is that for most advanced manufacturing, at least the use of Industry 4.0 technologies is standard just to be competitive. It's VR, AI, sensors, and IoT, and all of these things to assist with the supply chain. And to your point, there's a really interesting article in the news today about some AI research and how it's going to support us in the future. And I suppose I was talking about workers before and about the changing workforce. And absolutely, that's what our research showed, is that there's a serious change occurring in the workforce. And jobs aren't being necessarily replaced. They are being changed. They are different jobs. Jobs associated with coding and cyber now, and reduction in heavy lifting and jobs that were dangerous in the past. But most of the manufacturing companies, and this goes for the use of industrial land and all of that type of thing, which is becoming even more critical for cities as we go forward with, is that most of these places in the manufacturing and the supply chain, they're becoming almost considered dark factories, where you've got pretty much everything's automated. From the time the raw product goes in, comes out, and then it's taken over by an autonomous vehicle and put on a truck. And this is pretty much what we found was to be standard. Yeah, so absolutely, I think. And again, that starts to change where people live, the types of jobs they're going to have, and the types of economies that cities want to have as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a great example. And it got me thinking about that workshop that we were both at the other day, and how, like, there's unintended consequences as well. Obviously, you can already think about jobs and job losses or changes or, you know, skill sets, all those type of things as well. But one thing that we were talking about in our little group there was around, you know, the easier you make the supply chain, the longer it can get, which is not necessarily what we want, depending on what the source is, what we're talking about, like what if it's, we're talking about food at the time. And so there's those things as well. And so there's so many mechanisms, policies, levers that need to be pulled and, yeah, that can be pulled or not to really get those outcomes that we want. And I think that's where, if we're starting with the outcomes rather than, oh, well, this is technology is available or this is happening or whatever, then we can kind of backtrack or backcast what we actually want from those supply chains. And supply chains is just an example, but there's so many, the same things happens with cities. There's so many complexities and intricacies that we don't think about on a daily basis. But when we start thinking about those outcomes and how we get there, those things then fall out. And you can't solve all of them, of course, but it's like what's those important and priority things that we're talking about.
Yeah. And that's an interesting one, because and that's the other part about, like, political ambition versus the commercial realities. And so we're working on a project north of Brisbane, far north of Brisbane, and looking at the opportunity for the site to either use rail or road. So rail's got less environmental impact than road, but road wins out in a commercial argument. So basically, because of the commercial realities of things being able to go from, you know, A to B rather than rail, we find that is used because it's cheaper and more efficient, but it has more environmental impact. So that, for me, is where you start to, what are government's ambitions? And the government's reflective of what the community ambitions are. So, yeah, they're the types of things which I find fascinating, and that we're going to need to make decisions about more and more as we go forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for sharing that. I think it's really interesting. And also, you know, on the podcast, we talk about so many different aspects, but I think supply chains is something that I haven't talked about for a while, and it's something I want to continue to talk about. But also those, like, really linking those ambitions then with the commercial realities, thinking about both of those as well. And, you know, you can change the commercial viability or whatever through certain levers if the ambition is great enough, right? So there's those type of things as well that we often, like, I guess the general public may not think about when we, oh, well, why did, you know, that development go ahead? And it may be because, well, they're really, you know, strong on getting, I don't know, an innovation precinct happening or whatever. So there's so many things behind the scenes that are happening as well.
Yeah, that's right. But, and also, I think, you know, obviously the changing nature of commerce. So, we've been doing a lot of industrial land strategy around where cities might be placing their industrial lands or employment lands, as they're called. And because what we're finding is a lot of the cities, the industrial land is just becoming far, far too expensive. Yet we're seeing, from consumers' perspective, an increase in e-commerce and an expectation that it's going to get to them as quicker and quicker, you know, and like we were talking about with the Logan, you know, with drones, you know. So, so a lot of the stuff that we're doing is not the industrial land, not necessarily being the dirty industry that we're used to, but also being around distribution, logistics, and warehousing. And leaders like Goodman, and you might remember the one we saw in Tokyo, where they're vertically stacked, where they're providing really high-quality facilities for the workers, including childcare and all this type of thing, which still seems to me to be a benchmark. And, yeah, so it's something that, and again, that then goes to the supply chain. Well, how are these things going to get from wherever it's made to your doorstep, including the last mile, which is another discussion as well. So, but there's and this is what I'm talking about with the – we no longer deal with the status quo because of innovation in technology and because of people's expectation and because of the extra filter we've got around having to transition in terms of our energy use, we've got some serious complexity, and it's almost like there's always – every project that we do requires new thinking, not what we did last year or the year before.
Yes, I think new thinking is such a key one, and it's something that I've been thinking about as well in the projects that I do. Like, it's not, there's no cookie cutter like situation where you say, oh, well, we did this last time, let's do it again. You might use a similar methodology, you might tweak it, you might change it, but methodology potentially similar, but really depends. And then it depends on, when we're talking about clients, again, like you were saying, those ambitions. We can go up here, but if we know that politically it's never going to fly, do we still go up here and then we see what we can get? And there's so many things within it, but it's something I've been thinking about a lot. It's like new thinking, which, you know, can be tiring on your brain sometimes, continually new thinking.
Yeah.
Being pioneers, it's difficult work, but it's necessary and it's also enjoyable. I love it.
It is.
But, yeah, it is an interesting one as well. Okay, well, speaking of new thinking, let's talk about some of the projects and things you've been working on. I know we've already started talking about those, but, yeah, give us some projects you want to talk about.
Okay. Yeah, cool. Look, I've got three categories: physical, economics, and transport. So we recently did the Gold Coast Regional Botanic Gardens Strategic Direction Report. And that's interesting because, and before we got into it, we didn't really understand the role of the botanic gardens, but that's around conservation and education and research. So most people think you go in there and you're just, you know, well, we're just going to go have a look. But really, it's about the conservation of flora and fauna that is potentially no longer in existence for a variety because of, you know, population growth and change of climate and all sorts of things. So that's been a
wow, I didn't know that. That's
yeah.
Amazing.
So if you go to Melbourne or Sydney, you'll find there's a herbarium. That's where they grow and retain, and they also catalog all of these. And the intention is, so if you think of the Sydney and Melbourne and Hobart ones, they date back to European involvement in Australia, and they were used to primarily look at to test and research the types of plants that are going to work and survive, and that's continued to be the case. So that's been an interesting one because I just think, again, it just goes to this idea of transition and change and being able to, and the big thing about that is going to be able to, in a changing climate, what types of ecosystems can we continue to support? And then obviously there's all the digital visitor experience that's going to go along with that. In addition to, and this goes to that whole idea about technology and I suppose more traditional methods, is how do you find the nice balance between the experience of being out and about in nature, but also having digital innovation to support that journey and the education and the experience, whether that's augmented reality or VR, whatever it is. So that's been an interesting project. I think definitely everything that we're doing, because we're doing a lot of stuff in Southeast Queensland and up to Northern New South Wales, is responding to the significant floods that have occurred recently. And we usually are quite dependent on, you know, existing GIS data, Q100s, but they are kind of been thrown out the door because they've just been exceeded. And so in terms of data sets to support new development, they're kind of not there. And so that, you know, and that kind of takes a year or so to catch up. So that's a really interesting, I think, for any developers. I mean, that for me is going to be the big story of the next 10 years. How do big population growth areas respond to building in floodplains? You know, it's just, we need to talk about new thinking. We need to be super smart and really have deep thinking about how we design our places, how we architecturally respond to these issues. As an example, we're doing a sport and recreation strategy at the same time. And because these places are flood affected, half the year people can't get onto the fields because they're in flood prone areas. So we, again, and that's fine, you know, it's always been the case, but how do you protect those assets that sit in those floodplains and they're having to be replaced, you know, once a year? Or what is that? And because at the end of the day, we only have finite budgets. So we need to think really deeply, what's the technological solution for that? How do we use? But also, how do we just think really clearly about where we put our urban settlements? You know, yeah. So, yeah, it's been an ongoing thing for the last 3 years.
Yeah, that's an interesting one because, yeah, like you said, you know, placement, can we avoid having them in floodplains in the first place? All those type of things as well. And, like, we have finite budget, but we also have finite resources, right? Like, how often do you want to be able to, you know, do you want to be doing that if we can avoid it? And yeah, again, it's deep thinking, it's big thinking, there's deep technical thinking that's required, but also holistic kind of strategic thinking as well. There's community thinking that needs to be kind of pulled in there too. So yeah, no, really interesting projects, I think. And sometimes we probably, like, it's showing the maturity of this space increasing. Like, when we first started in this space thinking about smart cities, technology and data and all those type of things, but actually it's just about embedding that type of thinking in the things that we need to do regardless of whether smart cities, that term, continued to exist or not. It's like, well, actually, what this new thinking that we're talking about, what do we need to do? Because we can't just keep doing it the way we've always done it, right? And so I think that's an interesting piece, and we're seeing more and more of that happen where we're embedding the smart approaches and whatever they're called. Doesn't really matter, but it's about using that new way of thinking as we're talking about technology and data as those enablers.
Yeah, totally. The other thing, which is probably in terms of the content of your podcast, we've been pretty much since we last spoke on the podcast in 2018, is we've been doing a lot of work with operators and cities around micromobility strategy and deployment. So we've worked with the major operators in Australia and APAC and all around the country. And like I said, we're going to Malaysia tomorrow to help with some policy thinking for micromobility. And so micromobility, we're talking about e-bikes, e-scooters. And I suppose if we had this conversation in 2018, my view would have been that they shared e-bikes and privately or shared e-bikes and e-scooters were a tourism offering for cities or something. But as my journey has matured in the space, I'm seeing it as an absolutely critical part of every city's transport network work going forward. And just regardless of politics or community expectations, I'll be very surprised if in 5 years most cities, nearly every city in the world, doesn't have high mode share in private e-scooters and e-bikes and also shared. Just because of, in thinking about, we can't continue to have dominance of the private motor vehicle in cities. That's just ridiculous. and the denser the city, the more ridiculous it is, but also just because of the benefits around reduced carbon. So some of the policy stuff we're doing has done some things, has been looking at how cities are using it. In LA, for instance, we found that the different city councils requested that they're happy to provide an operator with an approval as long as they provide e-scooters in areas where there's low public transport access, which also correlated with lower socioeconomic areas. So it's being used to respond to transport inequality. Recently, we've seen one of the operators putting in e-mopeds, which can carry up to 200 kilos in Bogor City in Indonesia. Indonesia, again, getting towards this idea that private ownership, not necessarily necessary, and we can have shared responses. And then one of the more interesting one, if you've been down to Hobart recently, which is an absolutely stunning city, but everyone's fighting to get into the city in the car. Beautiful heritage city. They've recently adopted shared e-scooters into the city just because they're trying to find a solution to the rampant congestion. And interestingly, they're using digital twin technology to incorporate the data to make decisions about, well, is this going to be a vehicle-dominated road or can it be a pedestrianised street? And I think the other part, if I'm looking at moving into the future, one of the other things will be that the road reserve, as we know it, will change and it will be reallocated to different uses. So we're seeing that in Brisbane already. And that's absolutely, and again, the closer you are to the CBD or the more denser environment, the quicker that change will happen. I'm confident of that.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's like you were saying, 2018, you would have thought that, but also the industry has matured, the community using it has progressed, whatever the case is, you know, we're more aware of it. Obviously, there's, with any kind of mode of transport, you need to be cognizant of safety risks, all those type of things as well. I know there's lots in the news about it and whatever you think about that, but it's more like, is the infrastructure then there to support it? Are the policies there to support it? Because people are using it. It's a bit like, you know, when rideshare first came in, people were using it, you know, people were lagging behind kind of thing, right? So it's actually getting it forward.
Well, do you remember when you get in an Uber and it was elite, like the whole, everyone was saying, oh, well, how are we going to manage the road, you know, the verge, right? You know, it's impossible to happen. Now Uber is an absolutely like integral part of most people's lives.
Yeah, like it's so interesting. I think what you're talking about the curb and like the footpath and all those type of things, we need to be thinking about those now because we want to claw. And I mean, it's, for me, it's unfortunate that we had to, like, I don't know, we have to wait for this new kind of mobility to claw back the space for people and humans walking and that type of thing. But let's use this opportunity to make places for people. And some of them will be on these devices, some will be walking, some will be whatever your mode choice or whatever you have to use as a mode happens to be. But I do think it's about reallocating from non-motorized types of vehicles and that type of thing. But also thinking about, well, some places, yeah, you'll want those kind of high speed to and fro, whether that's rail, whether that's bus, whether that is private vehicle or, you know, a combination most likely. And particularly in regional areas, we know it's not a one-size-fits-all for everything. But then those place elements as well. So one of the things that's like not palatable so much is making it really difficult to drive in places, as in like, I hate driving here. Yeah, because we don't want cars here, right? It's easier to say like, oh, we're making this place for people. But actually, if you are making it harder for vehicles, it's a bit like the super block, which I'm very excited to visit again in Barcelona, where, you know, you look like, I think the cars are going 10. So cars are allowed in basically if you're a resident and you have a car parking in your building or whatever. So they're going 10 kilometers an hour or something like that. But the pedestrian in those areas is number one. So if you're standing, you know, on the road, which I was taking a photo, cars will just wait for you, right? And so you don't want to drive through there. You only do it if you absolutely have to, like getting out and then getting out, you know, onto the road or whatever. But there's literally like children's playgrounds in the middle of intersections and, you know, there's bikes. When I went, there was no scooters, but I don't know if there's scooters there now. So that will be an interesting one to see. But also it's a place for innovation so they can try out new things because they can safely do that. So yeah, it's a really interesting one, but I do think talking about it, actioning, you know, I was saying like awareness leads to focus, which leads to action, right? And then what we can actually do. But also thinking about those positive things that will come from that for people and being able to walk and cycle more effectively, more efficiently, if we are investing in that infrastructure as well.
And that's the hierarchy, isn't it? Like, what do we put the most importance on? Well, it's the car in Australian cities, and everyone else comes a very, very low second. But yeah, look, I mean, if you want to, we're seeing in Paris right now, you know, they're making it super difficult to own cars just because they got to the point of like, it's ruining the city. So, you know, you'd hope that you don't need to get to that point to put someone in a huge metal vehicle over the top of a family that's walking through the street in terms of who's got right of way. You know, I really struggle with, especially in city centres, I just struggle with the idea that I just think obviously we've got the hierarchy wrong in my perspective. And when you talk about place, there's no better way of responding to place than putting cars down the bottom and people up the top. But yeah, anyway.
But yeah, no, totally. And I think it's having those conversations, right? And as an engineer, getting the engineers to think that way as well is something that's really, you know, that's moving in that, definitely moving out of direct in the work. And the people that I know people doing great work in this space, they just bring it up in conversation. Sometimes that's all it takes to then actually be considered. And policy, obviously, because you need that to then, okay, this is, oh, we're pointing to this policy to say, oh, no, well, we have to do this unless there's a good reason not to, not the other way around. But yeah, and again, like all these things come into technology and data and as enablers to help us to do things better. I mean, data in particular for this case, like how can we use different sources to actually build evidence to say this is the way that we're going or that we are improving people's lives, like health, you know, all these things that we want to measure success on. I think we'll see more and more of those metrics come in rather than just this many people use the road. And thinking about congestion as a thing, like, I don't know, the more we focus on congestion being this problem, I'm just like, well, no, what are the outcome we want, right?
I went past a sign the other day that said, you are congestion. I was in there. I was like, I am. That's right. But I was thinking, you know, the other beautiful thing about shared micromobility is the data. Like, so because they've all got an IoT on, basically, so I was just looking at open data stuff for Melbourne this morning because I've got to whip up a prezzo. And it talks about how many trips each scooter is doing a day, how far they're going. You can get all the map, all the GIS maps. You can get the distance. But then the other stuff in the back end stuff that operators start to get is the user segmentation. So male, female, student, tourist, commuter. And so they're really starting to see this, like a depth of data that no other transport mode can give you. It is absolutely incredible. And that's why, like, I'm absolutely convinced that Brisbane and Melbourne are going to continue to invest heavily in active travel infrastructure because they know that pretty much every time that they continue to make it easier, they're taking another car off the road. You know what I mean? And the data supports it. So you can continue to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on these activities because the data shows that every time you spend more on it or the more you reallocate road reserve, you're going to increase the use. So everyone's happy, you know, the ratepayer's happy. Yeah, so the data's awesome, shared micromobility, and we'll just get better.
Yeah, I think usage is a key one. And we're talking about this. There's obviously like those privacy and security things that we need to really consider, but they need to be baked in from the very beginning. In terms of like people, individuals, trips and that type of thing. Like I like to mention that because it's not like we've forgotten about that, of course. But also gender disaggregated data is so important because we know that people move differently based on their gender identity. And we need to consider that because otherwise we continue to increase that divide more and more. So there's the gender, but then also like you were earlier talking about the socioeconomic, the equality, right? And yeah, when you look at that data as well, so then we can start to look at those unintended consequences of the policy decisions we're making or the intended consequences in a positive sense as well. And so then we can start to make better decisions. And I think sometimes we get scared of, well, what if we know that we've done this or that or the other? But then we can make better decisions, more informed decisions. And I think that's really key. And that's easier said than done, of course. And we're always thinking about that and how we can improve that. So, yeah, it's an interesting one for sure.
Yeah, I mean, more data is great, and also gut feels good as well to support it.
I think you need the what I call like the numbers and the stories, right? Like the qualitative and the quantitative.
But you're right, all the engagement that we do, we always build it in two ways. We want qualitative data sets and quantitative. So, you know, we want to be able to develop a graph that looks fantastic and identifies, you know, this many people see it. But we also want the stories. We want the attachment. We want to understand the relationships and the history of things that have happened, which you can't get in quantitative data sets. But we need both to be able to tell the story to government about why they're going to, why they should invest in certain projects and why it's important to the community that they go in one direction rather than another. So, yeah, again, that goes to that idea we started with, you know, like in terms of technology is fantastic, but it's got to only, it's one part of the story. And it's got to be, yeah, I think, and that's probably us, is that we're always looking to couple the technology with the traditional methods and the human-centered kind of approach to, at the end of the day, the reason we're doing all this is to create better cities. Trademark, sorry.
I believe you used that trademark when we were in Japan as well. I remember specifically walking down the street being smart cities. No, should be better cities.
Yeah, better cities. That's right.
Now, I'm looking at the time. We do need to wrap up. So we've had some great conversation on podcasts already. So let's talk about the future now. What are the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough?
Well, look, that's a great question. I think some of the geopolitical stuff that's going on is something that we as a country and as cities are going to need to think about, and that will be something I think over the next, and again, in our generation, it's probably not something that's necessarily been a massive issue, and certainly over the last couple of years is something that will, I think over the next few years will be something that we, that affects our cities and the way we live, and technology will be a big part of that, cybersecurity. So my view would be that that will be something that we haven't talked about for the last 3 years, but we'll definitely be talking about for the next three.
Yeah, and I think that goes into something I've been toying with as well, or just, I don't know, talking about on the podcast. It's like that, and we often talk about this, you know, smart cities over here, but it's actually that embedding of what we're talking about. But it's not separate to our whole big lives, right? Like it's affected by it, by, you know, both ways. What we do with technology affects our lives. What's happening in the world affects our lives, which affects the technology that's being created or being available, how we're using it, and all those type of things as well. And I often think that, like, the history of technology, and it's my new little pet project, the history of technology then can inform that kind of future as well, but also thinking about how they all work together. And then that, thinking about what we have available now, we can't really even fathom what we'll have available in the future as well. But anyway, some things thinking like that, but what's happening in our world will shape that as well. So I think that's a great one to bring up as well. Yeah. Well, Dan, it's been so great to have you on the podcast today. I look forward to catching up again soon. We're going to have like a smart cities catch up or something with everyone in this, I don't know, just something.
Well, we should have our Tokyo catch up lunch and try and get everyone, although everyone's gone on to bigger and better things.
They're everywhere. But anyway, we'll work something out. Well, thanks again for coming onto the podcast. Just one last question. How can people connect with you?
Yeah, so we've got Better Cities Group website, we've got Better Cities Group LinkedIn. I've got Dan Barr LinkedIn. And if people want to email me, I'm at danbarr@bettercitiesgroup.com. D-A-N-B-A-R-R @bettercitiesgroup.com.
Easy. I just send an email and it worked. Well, I assume it worked. I will put the links, or someone will. The team will put the links in the show notes so people can click away and find you. Thanks again for coming onto the pod. It's been great to chat again, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Brilliant. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Bye.
The Smart Community Podcast is brought to you by My Smart Community. If you're looking for support in podcast strategy and production, workshop design and facilitation, or communication and media advisory, get in touch. Email hello@mysmart.community or head to www.mysmart.community.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.com.
smartcommunity.community/podcasts. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.